This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us. We're ready to discuss the important events of this past week with our panel of trumpet writers. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Good to be here.
In our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
We are going to start by talking about two dangerous nations that are big in the news right now, Iran and North Korea. Both pose a threat to launch nuclear war, and we saw big developments on that front within both nations this week. In North Korea, an apparent step away from the nuclear ledge with a first-ever meeting between the leaders of North and South Korea. And in Iran, as we'll hear in this first report, revelations of extraordinary deception trying to hide efforts to obtain nuclear weapons. We'll start by hearing from our man in Jerusalem, Brent.
You may have seen this. It was a stunning display by Benjamin Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, on Monday night, standing before reporters in Tel Aviv in front of a big screen, gave a 20-minute presentation detailing Iran's work in the past on weapons of mass destruction, nuclear weapons. This was an archive that was discovered by Israeli spies, I guess, or operatives that removed, I believe it was about 100,000 files from a warehouse in Tehran in the past couple of weeks. So these are physical documents that Israelis were able to get out of the country, or at least came into Israel's control out of a warehouse. And it details a project which ran from 1999 to 2003. It was codenamed Ahmad. And the mission statement of this program was to design, produce, and test 5 warheads with 10 kiloton of TNT yield for integration on missiles. That was the mission statement for this. Of course, Iran has stated that it isn't seeking a nuclear weapon, that it doesn't have a nuclear weapons program. It never has had, never wants to have. It was only about last week where you had the foreign minister saying those exact words again. And then a couple of days later, Mr. Netanyahu blows the cover off the top of it with this revelation.
Can we just talk a little bit about the intelligence operation itself? I know we know nothing about this, but the idea that these folks were able to smuggle out this much physical evidence, this wasn't just, you know, finding the material on a hard drive somewhere. Netanyahu is standing there and he's pointing to this library of secret information. That is absolutely amazing to me.
Yeah, how do you airlift half a ton of documents out of Tehran without them, you know, catching wind of it?
We just have to applaud these guys.
Yeah, that's absolutely amazing. And this is actually something that is a kind of a big deal in Iran right now. How strong is our defensive establishment, how can we protect our nation when we see examples of Israelis or Israeli spies being able to do such a thing? I mean, Iranians and the rest of the world probably aren't too surprised that Iran had a nuclear program, but they are surprised that Israel was able to do this.
Yeah. So, you know, what strikes me is just how, and in some ways, I think it is a bigger story than even the what was revealed in the documents themselves. It seems that there are a lot of people who are basically trying to spin this as this really isn't a big deal. There's nothing new here. You know, we already knew this, and they're basically saying this is why we needed the deal in the first place. It just makes me wonder what it would take to convince people that there is a real problem here, that this needs to be dealt with far more forcibly.
Right. Well, what's interesting about this is a lot of these facts were known by decision makers at the time, that Iran did have a nuclear weapons program, regardless of what they say, what the Iranians say. This makes it public to absolutely everybody what they were out to achieve. The worrying thing is, there's been discussion, does this break the deal or doesn't it break the deal? There are clauses in the deal that says that Iran had to come clean on what they were doing as far as development of nuclear weapons, whether they were or not. You need to come clean and tell us about the possible military dimensions of your program. They did not do that. They lied to the IAEA. They lied to the other members of the P5 Plus or the members of the P5 Plus One, and they didn't reveal this. What's more, they kept the files. They kept all the work that they had, all the knowledge of what they had done up to 2003. They didn't destroy it. They kept it. Why do you keep such files unless you decide in the future to ramp up production again? Mm-hmm. And this is a point that is lost on many, many Western media outlets. I went on to Washington Post, I guess it was about 12 hours after the news broke, and I had to scroll down until I found an article on this.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't, the Washington Post, other media outlets were praising the nuclear deal as such a wonderful idea.
Mm-hmm.
We, of course, had the total opposite analysis of the nuclear deal. And now it's obvious for everybody in the world that we were conned. Mm-hmm. We were conned. Iran does want to produce a nuclear weapon.
Well, what does it take to the perversity and the logic is we know that they're liars. That's why we have to make a deal with them. That's an extraordinary just misunderstanding of how the world works. It's kind of, I guess that's at the bottom line of the way that people are approaching this.
Exactly. And I think that is even what our editor-in-chief pointed out at the very beginning of this nuclear arrangement. He said, and this is from his article, Negotiating Human Survival, he says, many people are hailing the new, and this was written at the time, I believe it was July, maybe 2016. Many people are hailing the new nuclear agreement with Iran, but this whole deal hinges on trust. Can Iran be trusted? In the past 2 decades, Iran has broken, violated, and lied about 20 agreements made with it. Do we think its behavior will change? And this is revealed that Iran has this goal, had this goal, will have this goal for the future. And what I think an article from National Review actually brings it out quite well, and this is that while Iran did shelve, it looks like, its nuclear weapons program, it has been working on the other key element for a nuclear weapons program, that is the delivery system. The P5 Plus One wanted ballistic missile research and development as part of the nuclear deal. The week before, Iran said, that's a deal breaker. We are not adding ballistic, any type of attack, slow down our ballistic missiles. It's mm-hmm. not going to be part of the deal. And so what has Iran been doing? We've seen them test fire how many ballistic missiles while this deal has been in effect.
Mm-hmm.
So they have been busy with their nuclear program, just not about with the nuclear weapon part of it. In the past 3 years.
Well, let's just talk about the effects of Netanyahu's revelations here, Israel's revelations. It does seem like he definitely timed this in a way that would convince Donald Trump not to recertify the deal or to break this agreement, as there's a lot of pressure right now on, you know, which direction is Donald Trump going to break on this. And yet at the same time, you do wonder, just looking at the response of so many people saying basically, you know, it doesn't matter what is in those documents. This only proves that we need to have a deal with Iran. Well, what direction do you expect this to go?
Yeah, May 12th is the date. It's not too far away now that Mr. Trump has to decide whether he's going to snap back sanctions as much as he can on Iran if they pull out. The big question is, what's Europe going to do? European leaders said they want to stay within the nuke deal even after these revelations, which was kind of surprising. Well, not necessarily surprising. That's what I thought they would say. But they do want to focus on including elements. And we've talked about this before. Ballistic missiles must be a part of the new deal, or it will be nixed. What's happening in Syria, what Iran's doing in Syria, must be part of the new deal, or it will be nixed. That's the European position.
Mm.
And so we'll see what happens over the next 10 days for that. I wouldn't be surprised if there's another revelation from Netanyahu, that he tends to keep some information back. I wouldn't be surprised if there's more to come out in the lead up to that decision as well. But already it is pushing Europe incrementally towards the American position and at least providing justification for Donald Trump's pullout of the deal. As I said, I think it was last week, Iran is not going to pull back or change. It's a question of whether that is really sinking in to the Europeans. Mm-hmm. This was for the Europeans more than this announcement, more than anybody else, I believe, to try and sway them away from wanting to continue the nuclear deal.
Hmm. Well, if you want more information about this, there is the article that Brent referenced from Gerald Fleury called Negotiating Human Survival. There's also the article that he wrote at the beginning when the deal was first struck. He called it the worst foreign policy disaster in America's history. He also has a booklet called Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door about just how important this subject of nuclear war is when you look at it from the standpoint of biblical prophecy. And really, that leads right into our next story, over to North Korea now. This historic meeting between the leaders of North and South Korea that has a lot of people talking about a new era of peace on the Korean Peninsula. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, many in the West are just overjoyed by these recent developments in North Korea. Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un crossed the border into the South last week. That was the first time any North Korean leader has entered the South for as long as the two have existed as separate nations. And so he and South Korean President Moon Jae-in, they agreed to formally end the Korean War by the end of this year. Up until this point, it's only been at a truce since 1953. And then Kim also committed to complete denuclearization. And historically, when the North has talked about denuclearizing the peninsula, it has meant that the U.S. also has to stop kind of extending its, you know, nuclear umbrella over South Korea. So basically, it's meant, yes, we'll denuclearize if the United States will get all of its troops out of the South. But this time, Kim specified that the offer comes with no requirements to end the U.S.-South Korea alliance or to oust American troops from the peninsula. And he's even invited experts and journalists from America and from South Korea to watch later this month as he dismantles the nuclear testing site where all six of North Korea's nuclear tests have happened. And now Kim is scheduled to meet with U.S. President Donald Trump sometime in the next few weeks. And ahead of that visit, he's extended a real olive branch, I guess, to the U.S. He just released three U.S. citizens who are being held in one of North Korea's terrible prison camps. So on the surface, it really looks like, you know, peace and love are in the air. But if we look at the recent history of North Korea, then we see that there's still very good reason to be skeptical about this sudden U-turn that Kim Jong-un has made. In 1985, for example, North Korea signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and then they continued to develop their nuclear weapons quietly. In 1992, very similarly, they signed a major denuclearization deal with the South, and that same year they signed a safeguards deal with the International Atomic Energy Association, the IAEA. And then just 1 year later, Pyongyang refused to let the IAEA inspect parts of its nuclear holdings, and they threatened to withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And then in 1994, another big denuclearization promise with the agreed framework, and then a short time later, they were found to be continuing their development of enriching uranium, their capacity to enrich uranium. And then once again in the year 2000, that time there was even a Nobel Peace Prize awarded to the South Korean president for his efforts at orchestrating a big peace on the peninsula. A couple of years after that, the North detonated their first nuclear bomb. Mm-hmm. And then it all happened once again in 2007. So in each of these cases, North Korea's promises were welcomed by the world with hope and with optimism. And the North was very often rewarded with foreign aid and with the relaxing of sanctions. And then each time the North broke the promises. And today it's a nuclear armed nation. So, you know, maybe this time around is different. There are reasons to really wonder what's happening there. But if you look at North Korea's track record over the last 30 years, I think it shows that it's too early to break out the bottles of soju.
Well, it seems, too, like it's remarkable that this is happening so soon after what you'd have to say in a lot of ways was the most belligerent that North Korea has ever been. It was just a year ago that we were they were testing missiles that were able to reach the U.S. even across the entire continental United States. It seemed like we were closer to actual, you know, warfare between the United States and North Korea than we had ever been. Suddenly there's an about face. I just wonder, you know, as much as people want to credit Donald Trump, the South Korean president, he's talked about that Donald Trump should get a Nobel Peace Prize for what's happening here.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the idea that Kim is making these moves because of a failure in his own nuclear facilities?
That report made the rounds pretty broadly, that the mountain that they had used to conduct their nuclear tests had collapsed, the primary tunnel. But if you look at the 38 North analysts who actually are in charge of monitoring satellite data of North Korea, they are very skeptical that there's a geological motivation for this decision. Even if that primary tunnel did collapse, there's several other facilities where they could quickly relocate these tests. So maybe that was partly a factor, but from what I can tell, the experts that are in charge of knowing that kind of thing for the, you know, for the welfare of the world, they don't believe that that was actually a big consideration.
So I guess another thing that would give you pause to remain skeptical about his motivations is just how critical nuclear weapons have been to propping up his power personally as the leader of North Korea.
Yes. Yeah, that's a huge factor here. You know, for 30 years, he has starved his people in order to develop nuclear weapons. He has withstood and sort of suffered these horrible sanctions and this economic isolation in order to keep on pursuing nuclear weapons. He's basically burned almost every bridge there is in order to develop nuclear weapons because he feels that they are crucial for his regime's survival. It's the only way he can guarantee that someone as powerful as the United States or the South, who is backed by the United States, wouldn't invade him and try to orchestrate regime change. And so the idea that he would suddenly dismantle his nuclear arsenal, not to mention all the missiles designed to deliver those warheads, that idea, you know, that would leave the North with nothing to deter an attack like that. And it would deprive Kim of the very thing that has enabled his backward and impoverished nation to even negotiate as an equal with the far more powerful South Korea, and even to pressure the United States, the vastly more powerful and wealthy United States, to come to the negotiating table. So nuclear weapons have legitimized his regime in a way that nothing else could. And without them, he's just a ninth-rate nation with a decaying conventional arsenal, very little meaningful leverage over any nation besides South Korea, and basically just a blip on the American radar. So I think the idea that he would just suddenly say, oh, you know what, we don't need these after all, I think it's very, very unlikely.
Right, and that he would trust those other nations. I mean, that basically is what it would come down to, is we, the folks who are looking at this and saying, wow, this is great news, are essentially believing that Kim Jong-un is saying, you know what, if I'm just nice to these people, I'll bet they'll be nice to me. And there's absolutely zero evidence to show that he actually thinks that way.
Right. And in fact, there's lots of evidence to the contrary. He would be well aware of the situation in Libya, where Gaddafi was pressured into giving up his nuclear weapons program shortly after he was ousted from office and brutally killed. Same thing with Saddam Hussein. He gave up his nuclear weapons program before it was viable. He was ousted from office and killed as well. Then Ukraine, even. They had the world's third largest arsenal of nuclear weapons right after the U.S. and the Soviet Union. But in 1994, they signed a big deal with the United States saying, we'll give them up if you promise to defend us if we're ever invaded and if anybody ever threatens to redraw our borders. Well, 20 years later, Ukraine was invaded and Russia redrew their borders and took one of their most valuable chunks of land there, Crimea. So that just exposed that America's promises were utterly hollow. So, you know, Kim Jong-un would be well aware of all of these cautionary tales. And I think that all of that would make him, you know, rightfully mistrust the idea that you can just sort of have faith in promises and assurances.
Well, Jeremiah's written an article called Peace and Prosperity on the Korean Peninsula, ? You can find that on thetrumpet.com within the next day or two. That will post very soon. And we also, again, I just want to point you to the Nuclear Armageddon is at the Door booklet by Gerald Fleury, where he puts all of these developments in context. And he writes a lot about North Korea and the North Korean nuclear threat in that booklet, and shows how the real concern that we need to keep our eye on is Russia and China, and just how much those nations have propped up the Kim regime. It's definitely something to the perspective that you need about what's going on in that part of the world. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our Week in Review program on 101.3 KPCG. New budget numbers from the European Commission show a possible path to establishing a European army. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
So a couple of years ago, we talked about Europe's new border force. And at the time, we said, this is a tiny force, but it establishes a huge principle that Europe is saying they're creating this force that can deploy to any part of the European Union, or at least any part of the Schengen area, without the government's permission. It doesn't even have to be invited or even approved by the host government, and it can go there. And that's huge. That's the understanding of sovereignty in the Western world for the last 400 years is completely upended by that. No longer does the government of each European country they're not longer the only authority that's legitimately allowed to deploy force within their borders. And you know, what we said at the time, I remember sitting in exactly the same setup saying, well, they've got this approved with a tiny force. That's probably why they've got this approved. No one's really threatened by a border guard force 1,500 strong. But now they've got this established, they'll ramp it up. And that is exactly what the proposals in the latest budget for the spending over the next 7 years, or for the 7 years from 2020 to 2027, call for. Increasing this 1,500 strong force to 10,000 strong. So something now that is much more substantial. At the same time, they call for some changes in how the naval part of this force works, basically making the naval part deployable anywhere, anytime, without host government permission, in the same way that the land force is already able to act. And then also, you know, they haven't published the full details. At the moment, this 1,500 strong force is made up of border guards that are on loan from various different EU countries. It looks like they want to change that so there's kind of more like a standing border guard force, a standing corps. So you are looking like something that has a lot of the features of an EU army. It can go anywhere within Europe. It's 10,000 strong. Doesn't have to have the target nation's approval. Now, of course, it's not all the way there to an EU army. 10,000 is still fairly small. It's a border force, so they're going to be armed with guns. They're not going to have tanks, fighter jets, you know, battleships, none of those components. But this is still another important step, establishing that kind of European-wide military force.
The desire to create a European military, this is obviously something that has been on the table for a long time. There's been a lot of obstacles over the years. After Brexit, we talked about how that accelerated the timetable. And as you said, when this was first proposed, the idea was that the principles that they established here would be able to be ramped up at some point. So here we're seeing basically a fulfillment of what we had expected. You're kind of seeing the trend and the thinking behind these European leaders at play in this budget proposal.
That's right. And you know, we've seen this accelerated before. When they first proposed this common budget and border force, they were saying, we expect this to be set up around 2035.
Wow.
That's the force that was set up in 2016. They were expecting 2035 before the migrant crisis hit. Migrant crisis hit, then it was kind of like, well, we've got these plans on the table. We need to get through this much faster. And so, again, I think you can see, you see the direction of travel with what they put forward. Now, they are still long-term plans, but you could definitely see as events impact Europe, them even speeding some of these up. I think one thing that's very interesting, I think it was Handelsblatt made the comment when they were talking about this, that this is about the least controversial part of the upcoming budget. It's also the EU border agency is getting about the biggest increase of any part of the budget. They're seeing their spending close to being, or their budget being close to triple. So it is interesting that spending on this force and such a big jump in that spending is about the least controversial part. You know, everybody in Europe is eager for some kind of action on defending the borders. And I think that's what we see. And this is just one aspect of a whole range of different efforts that Europe is putting towards a military force. And we've talked on this show a fair bit about the way that Germany is working with individual nations, and it's brought 2/3 of the Dutch army in under the German army, a huge chunk of the Romanian army, of the Czech army, under the German army. Mm-hmm. So this is one of several initiatives. It shows what Europe is thinking. It shows what European leaders want, their priorities. It's a potential path to an EU military. It certainly establishes some of the principles, but I think it's one component of a much broader picture. And there's a whole range of different ways you could see this play out. You could see, you know, maybe say there's something else, a repeat of, say, the breakdown that you had in Greece in 2009 with massive riots. And you've got a force that can legally be deployed anywhere in Europe and is actually quite beefy now. You could see that its mandate being stretched in those circumstances. You could see some of its powers being awarded to a different body. You know, lots of ways that this could play out. But it shows a lot of that intent. And this is exactly one, you know, this is one of the big things that we've been watching for. In 1953, Mr. Armstrong talked about 10 powerful European nations, he said, will combine their forces. In August 1958, he wrote, the Europeans are far more disturbed about their safety and relying on the United States military power to protect them than Americans realize. And that's even more true today under President Trump. He wrote then that Europeans want their own military power. And that's what we see. Mr. Armstrong also wrote about the difficulties in forming this military power, that Europe would require a lot of pressure before they did it. But we're seeing this work moving towards that end. And Mr. Armstrong based that on a whole range of prophecies in the Bible. You know, Daniel chapter 2, Daniel chapter 7, Revelation 13 and 17, they all talk about this coming European military power. And Revelation 17 especially, it describes a union of 10 kings, and it says that this union of these different kings, these different nations, have one mind, and they make war. You know, you put that together, and you have some kind of military alliance, some kind of unified military. That's what the Bible says is coming. That's what we're seeing Europe working towards in a variety of different ways now. We have one of our trends articles on this subject, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Towards Unified Military, and that will take you through much more of those statements from Mr. Armstrong, what he was saying, will take you through in much more detail those scriptures and just really proving and establishing that scriptural foundation of why we are watching for this military in Europe. Because it is something that has a very solid Bible basis, and that article, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Towards a Unified Military, will take you through that.
All right. And also, Richard has an article up on the website today. Is Europe's border force about to become its army? You can check that out on thetrumpet.com. We appreciate that, Richard. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. On the Trumpet Daily Radio Show, Stephen Fleury has been covering the ins and outs of the investigations and scandals surrounding the Trump presidency. And a lot of evidence has emerged of just how aggressive the radical left is in tightening its hold on power. In all the revelations about this story, one very troubling one is the degree of collusion these government officials have had with the press. And this has been highlighted by what some of these officials are doing since being ousted from their government positions. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, well, it definitely comes as a surprise to almost no one that there's media bias in the United States. That's been true for a couple of decades. But a couple shocking new revelations this week just highlight how deep that bias goes, even into collusion with outlets like CNN and NBC, almost acting like arms of the information arms of the FBI and the CIA. Now, last Saturday, they had the annual White House Correspondents' Dinner. And at that dinner, the CNN News Network actually won an award for its role in exposing a meeting between Barack Obama's four top intelligence chiefs with Donald Trump, briefing them about this this Russian report with those unverified rumors of collusion with the Russian network that we've covered on this program before. And so on that hand, it's almost kind of a shocking that just how brazen it is that they'd actually give an award for right. leaking classified information.
Yeah.
And that's not even the most shocking part of the story, is that a little earlier this month, the House of Representatives released a huge 253-page report on the Russian investigation that they're still going through, because there's a lot in there. But one of the big things to come out of that report is that one of the director of national intelligence under Barack Obama, James Clapper, actually met with CNN journalist before that report and told them about the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
And so then lied to Congress about it afterwards. And so the leak wasn't like a low level intelligence official. The leak was from the director of national intelligence going to a CNN news network, telling them about this classified meeting, and then having CNN go on to broadcast that to the entire nation and win a press award for doing so.
Right. They both have the same goal, don't they?
Right. They definitely both have the same goal to undermine the Republican Party or the Trump presidency. And that's, I mentioned at the beginning, is that some of that bias has been around for decades, where you'll see certain left-wing media agencies and certain left-wing government agencies that seem like they're colluding because they have the same goals. But in this case, you actually have a sitting director of an intelligence giving information to these media outlets, which doesn't make them much difference than like Pravda mm-hmm. under the Soviet Union.
Right.
And they've got a report in the tablet titled "Our NBC and CNN Paying Off Top Spies Who Leaked Info with On-Air Jobs." And they're actually mentioned that Jake Tapper, now after obviously President Trump didn't keep him on as the director of national intelligence, he got his own director of national intelligence, but then CNN then hired him as a security analyst.
Mm-hmm.
And they point out that too, that and that's from the director of national intelligence, but also the CIA director, John Brennan, was also hired by NBC as a national security analyst. And they don't necessarily have proof that John Brennan leaked anything personally, like Jake Tapper. But under his administration, the CIA had definitely leaked the whole story about the Russians hacking the Democratic National Convention was revealed in a secret CIA report, which someone, maybe not John Brennan himself, but someone who works for John Brennan, leaked to the media. So now you've got huge leaks coming from the director of national intelligence to CNN and from the CIA to NBC. And both of those directors got good paying analysis jobs at those two news networks. Susan Rice is another one, is one of Barack Obama's national security advisors who now sits on the board of directors for Netflix. So now you've got like Netflix, CNN, NBC, all being with high-level positions being run by people who were intelligence chiefs under the Barack Obama administration and who were getting information from the departments run by those intelligence chiefs under Barack Obama's administration.
This reference you made to Pravda and state-controlled media, I think that this is – it's just phenomenal how strong
the relationships have been, and so much of the time they're not out there in the open. There's a lot of these types of relationships that are happening behind the scenes, but a whole lot has been exposed over this past year that shows you've got basically major segments of the government colluding with the mainstream of the press in ways that really eliminate the role of the press as a objective reporting on what's going on in the government.
Right. That's you've got, and this is like a what you'd call a constitutional crisis, and that constitutionally there's only three branches of government. These intelligence agencies work for the president. But now when you've got these intelligence agencies trying to undermine the president, and even colluding and hijacking elements of the press in that effort, you've got something where the executive branch of the federal government is at war with itself, and getting press support in the case of like these intelligence agencies even leaking information to the press. And then you've got on the other side something like Fox News, which hasn't done anything illegal, but's more supportive of the president himself. That's just highlighting into this deep national division, not only amongst the American people and the American government, but even within branches in the American government. It does just really highlight what Christ told the Pharisees in Matthew 12 when he said, every kingdom divided against itself is brought to desolation, and every city or house divided against itself shall not stand. To where if you've got the American government not only divided against itself in opinion, but actually working elements within the government itself to undermine their boss, to sabotage their boss, to leak information to media outlets, this is undermining America's stability and leading to a case where the nation is brought to desolation, to make an exact quote. And this is something that, for more information, our editor-in-chief has written in a book called America Under Attack, where he takes a much bigger picture of even like the spiritual elements, like the spiritual forces that are working to rip America apart. And this collusion between the far-left media and America's intelligence agencies like the CIA and FBI are a big part of that.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to talk about China's lies about its militarization of the South China Sea, Iranian activity in North Africa, wrangling over German defense spending, and it's Karl Marx's 200th birthday today, the author of the Communist Manifesto, and guess who's out there saying he was right? We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
We spoke in the first half about how North Korea has broken previous promises to denuclearize. You could say similar things about China. More evidence has emerged of China's militarization of some islands in the South China Sea. And it's important to remember that all of this activity directly contradicts some promises China made in the past. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, this news broke just yesterday that China has placed anti-ship cruise missiles and surface-to-air missile systems on three of its artificial islands in the South China Sea. So these deployments just happened in the last 30 days, and they were on Fiery Cross Reef, Subi Reef, and Mischief Reef, all of which are in the Spratly chain there. And these are really advanced weapon systems. The anti-ship missiles have a range of about 250 miles, and the surface-to-air missiles are able to hit aircraft and incoming missiles out to a range of about 125 miles. So it's some very advanced weaponry, and we don't yet know how many of these missiles have been deployed to each island, but these systems give the Chinese military a capability that goes far beyond anything needed just for self-defense. These really let China build a robust and a multi-layered kind of a military umbrella around the entire South China Sea, because they're right there in the center of it. And they basically just cement Beijing's ability to control this vital and very strategic region.
So this is not what China said that it was going to do.
It's not. It was only in September of 2015 that Chinese President Xi Jinping was visiting President Obama in the United States, and he stood there in the Rose Garden, and he was directly asked about these islands, and he promised that China did not plan to militarize them. His exact quote was, "There is no intention to militarize." And several times since then, he's stressed that these are for civilian purposes. No, that's a ridiculous, ludicrous notion that we would militarize these. So, I mean, that was suspect and very questionable from the beginning. But now there are just mountains of evidence showing that that was an utter lie and that China is taking over this region by force.
Mm-hmm. You know, when these types of things happen, I just think of Revelation 12 and verse 9, where it talks about the devil having deceived the whole world, and just how our world is cloaked in deceit. It's something that we just see routinely. You definitely see this in international relations, and it seems to be happening at an increasing pace.
Yes, that's right. And in this particular area, the South China Sea, this deceit is it's very high stakes game there. You know, Trump editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has said that China's militarization of these islands is steering the world toward war. And of course, they've militarized them with that deception. In the July 2016 print edition, he wrote a very powerful article by that title. It's called "China is Steering the World Toward War." And one part of it says, "These militarized islands now function as forward bases for Beijing to challenge 7 decades of American naval dominance in the Pacific Rim. This should alarm the world." And then he goes on to discuss Deuteronomy 28:52, which talks about a besiegement that'll be orchestrated by China and other revisionist powers. And Mr. Fleury, very powerfully in that article, just shows that China's militarization of these islands is one area in the world where we can already see this prophecy in Deuteronomy moving toward its fulfillment. Mm-hmm. So we'll make sure to have a link to that article in the show notes. And I would just really encourage any listener who hasn't read that to go there and read Mr. Fleury's article.
Thanks for that, Jeremiah. We spoke in the first half about exposing Iran's secret nuclear archives. This week, there was another bombshell about Iran's dangerous activities dropped some 2,500 miles away. For this story, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, the Moroccan foreign minister returned back from Tehran this week, and on May 1st, he had an assembly of reporters there and basically said that we are cutting off diplomatic relations with Iran. And the reason being, Iran has been caught by Moroccan officials red-handed just this past month, sending weaponry via Hezbollah, via the Iranian embassy in Algiers, next door to Morocco, and then into the hands of the supposed freedom fighters that are wanting Western Sahara to be a separate country from Morocco. And those weapons included surface-to-air missiles, similar to the ones that I guess appear in the Spratly Islands. They also sent other types of missiles as well. And this comes after the Moroccans had been tracking more Iranian involvement, more Iranian training as well of this other terrorist entity, a terrorist entity that you wouldn't think naturally would be a support of Iran or a natural ally of Iran. And yet this kind of does speak to Iran's policy of destabilizing nations where it can, funneling weaponry into their hands and training for their own future gain, just like what we've seen in take place in Yemen.
So you talk about Yemen. That's obviously very strategically important to Iran with respect to controlling the oil transit points in the Persian Gulf and so on. Why Morocco?
Yeah, that's why what Michael Rubin tried to answer in his piece about this, why Iran is trying to sabotage Morocco. And I'd just like to quote from him now. He said, "If they can destabilize Morocco, they and their proxies can threaten shipping at the Strait of Gibraltar, a strategic choke point every bit as important as the Strait of Hormuz and the Bab el-Mandab, which is the one off Yemen's coast, both of which Iranian missiles and suicide boats now threaten." So if you can see this picture, and we've been talking about this, and Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has been writing about this for years, of Iran's strategy in the southern Mediterranean and the Red Sea. They want to control the choke points. And so they are mobilizing proxies, giving them such weaponry as these surface-to-air missiles, which the Houthis have from Iran, and trying to then jeopardize trade through these areas, at least have some type of control over these areas. And the Straits of Gibraltar are right there, the western or the entry point to the Mediterranean. If they can control the Bab el-Mandab, we know that prophecy indicates that they're going to control the Suez as well. And now they want to make a play for the Straits of Gibraltar. We are seeing Bible prophecy here come alive just as we expected. We might not have expected them to control Gibraltar or at least threaten that. We've talked about them pushing as far as Algeria, but it isn't surprising, given that we know that they want to control the southern Mediterranean, that they would push to get a proxy in Morocco as well.
And surely Europe would have a whole lot to say about that if Iran made any further moves that direction.
You would think so, but we've been waiting for the Europeans, as even we brought out in the Iran story earlier, to wake up and realize what Iran is doing, just, you know, in the soft underbelly of Europe.
Thank you, Brent. Germany is in discussion to significantly increase its defense spending. We'll hear a bit of this going back to Britain from Richard Palmer.
So the German government wants to spend an additional 5.5 billion euros. However, that's not enough for the defense ministry. I think the defense minister, Ursula von der Leyen, is playing a very tough game. She's basically trying to hold the government to ransom, saying this increase is not sufficient. And she's threatening to cancel a bunch of deals that would be very politically difficult for Angela Merkel, that would hurt the German arm manufacturing industry, hurt Germany's credibility abroad, basically threatening to throw the toys out of the pram if she doesn't get what she wants. At the same time, German foreign policy makes an interesting point where they just point out some of Germany's commitments to developing new weapons and show that the arms spending doesn't come close to meet these plans that they've already made. For example, Germany has committed to work with France they're at least looking into making a new battle tank. They've committed to make a new plane with France, something to be kind of similar to the F-35. They're talking about making a new warship because they're worried about Russia in the Baltic. That's the MKS 180. So lots of big commitments. So it looks like, yes, Germany is going to be beefing up their military, but actually we should expect many more announcements that they're going to beef it up or be spending much more than they already announced this week. So you could go back to that same article even that we mentioned earlier to learn more about what we're watching for in Europe, that why the Trumpet watches Europe's push towards a unified military. And again, that goes through those prophecies about a militarily strong European power that we're seeing coming. Obviously, Germany is at the heart of Europe. And you know, if Germany follows through on what they're being pushed to do, if they spend 2% of their economy on their military, as Donald Trump wants them to, well, they'll be a bigger military spender than Russia. So we are looking like at a major geopolitical shift here as Germany does spend more.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we'll leave it there, Richard, and move on to our last story. If Karl Marx were still alive, he'd be 200 years old today. And while his ideas, famously expounded on in his works, The Communist Manifesto and Das Kapital, they've been discredited and proven wrong in the real world, in the minds of some people, he is still very much alive. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
In the minds of an increasing number of people, it seems, Marx's ideas are still very much alive. Just this Monday, they published an editorial at the New York Times entitled, "Happy Birthday, Karl Marx, You Were Right." And well, in recent years, it's probably not as shocking that the New York Times would publish that headline. Even a decade ago, that would have been a pretty shocking headline from the New York Times. The New York Times was not considered a far left or a pro-communist newspaper during the Cold War or even during the Yeltsin years and the early Putin years. It's really only been in the past 10 years or so that they've really kind of been pushing to rehabilitate this Marxist ideology. And when you read through the piece, it's talking about you were right. And I guess to their credit, it does admit that not everything Karl Marx said was right. obviously, that led to the death of 100 million people as regimes around the world tried to implement his ideas. But it really focuses on the two main things.
That's just a little bit of a side point, though. But on the whole, I mean, apart from the 100 million people who died, on the whole, he was right.
And apart from the million people, they zeroed in on two things that they really think that he hit the nail on the head on. One, as they said, he thought his critique of capitalism with about like the upper class exploiting the labor of the lower class was spot on. And two, they really endorsed his like materialistic view that mankind has the capability to solve this, mm-hmm. as spot on. And they actually do a quote from something Marx said where he says, "If previously the gods had dwelled above the earth, now they became its center." And I guess it's kind of a weird poetic way of explaining. He said, in the past, this has said, we look to God or the gods, depending on your religion, to solve our problems. Now there is no God. The gods are at the world's center. It's basically mankind is God.
Mm-hmm.
The collective will of mankind is like, we can use the power of the state or the power of the community to solve the problems of the free market system.
Yeah, that thinking really is at the heart of so much of the trouble that you see in the world today. You can point to, you know, Stalinist purges and you know, those places where you've implemented a specifically communist ideology on the scale of what Karl Marx was promoting, but just the increase in statism, the increase in government power and welfare. The welfare state, that really goes back to the idea that the state is the one that has the answers and should be the one to provide for the people rather than them being responsible for looking after themselves.
Yeah, one other, I mean, it is amazing to see how much Marxist thought has seeped into so many areas of society. But one of those things that, you know, Mr. Obama would talk all the time about the arc of history. And this is a Marxist idea that's everywhere. That history has a destination, that mankind's constantly improving. I mean, it does obviously tie in with other ideologies like Darwinism and evolution, but this, our human nature is getting better and that governments are inevitably going to be the ones to fix these problems, is mainstream now.
Right, yeah, you see that in all sorts of places. Like I said, even whether they argue over exactly how it should be implemented, the idea that human beings can solve their own problems was very revolutionary when Marx proposed it. Mm-hmm. A lot of Western civilization at the time was saying that, had the idea that human nature was evil, mankind has fell during the Garden of Eden. And the idea that, Marx's idea that no, there is no God and mankind has its own answers was revolutionary at the time, but taken for granted in large swaths of society today. I actually brought with me a quote from Whitaker Chambers that actually, for anyone who takes a Christian view that mankind is fallen, sends chills down your spine, even though Karl Marx himself probably wouldn't have been offended by this quote in any way. But it says, "Henceforth, the Communist Party is quite justified in calling itself the most revolutionary party in history. It has posed in practical form the most revolutionary question in history, God or man. It has taken the next logical step which 300 years of rationalism hesitated to take and said what millions of modern minds think but do not dare to say. If man's mind is the decisive force in the world, what need is there of God? Henceforth, mankind's mind is mankind's fate."
Mm. Yeah, it is chilling. When you think of it in terms of the biblical truth, as it says in Jeremiah 17, verse 9, that the human heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And really, that understanding is at the heart of understanding the Bible, understanding human nature, understanding why the world looks the way it does, just how dangerous human beings can be under the sway of the devil. And boy, you look at what happened in those nations that implemented Karl Marx's ideas, and you see a whole lot of that influence. Well, that will do it for today's program. Thanks for that, Andrew. You can visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com for links to the articles and the literature we discussed on the program today. Email us your thoughts at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to be here.
It's been a pleasure.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.